Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service, filling in for George Douglas. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine. This issue is February 15th, 2013. This magazine is the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we start out today's reading with the main stories. The main story today is China's increasingly aggressive cyber war. What happened? The U.S. government rushed to bolster the nation's cyber defenses this week after suspected Chinese hackers launched a string of audacious attacks on major American media organizations, including the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. In a front-page story, the Times revealed that its computer system has been persistently attacked for 4 months after it ran an exposé of the billion-dollar fortune amassed by relatives of China's Prime Minister Wen Jiabao. The perpetrators stole the passwords of Times employees and broke into the email accounts of bureau chiefs in Asia. Experts traced the attacks back to computers at a Chinese university. Following the story's publication, the Journal, Bloomberg News, and the Washington Post revealed that they had also been targeted by Chinese hackers after reporting on the regime. And just last week, the Federal Department of Energy, which maintains the U.S. nuclear arsenal, also had its computers hacked, with the evidence pointing to China. The new wave of cyber attacks comes amid growing concern that China is mounting a widespread campaign to infiltrate computer systems throughout the U.S. in order to steal classified information, conduct industrial espionage, and identify internal critics who speak to Western media. Officials in Beijing denied any involvement in the hacks, calling the claims, quote-unquote, unprofessional and baseless. But in response to the growing threat of state-sponsored cyber war, the Pentagon announced it was hiring 4,000 extra code crackers, online security experts, and hackers to boost its Cyber Command Division, which currently employs 900 people. Outgoing Defense Secretary Leon Panetta has warned that foreign hackers could derail the computer systems that undergird the nation's transportation, utility, and financial networks, causing a cyber Pearl Harbor. What the editorial said. China badly miscalculated this cyber offenses, said the Wall Street Journal, by going after Western media organizations that exposed official corruption and repression, the regime has revealed just how terrified it is of its own citizens being exposed to the truth. Whatever they think they've learned about us by sneaking around our inboxes, the world has learned a great deal more about them. Cyber war is no longer a science fiction fantasy, said the Washington Post. Every day, state-sponsored hackers from China, Russia, Iran, and other hostile nations attack our banks, government offices, and corporations, including Google, Lockheed Martin, and Nortel, seeking to steal secrets and test our defenses. If the Pentagon's new cyber warriors manage to stop enemies from turning out the lights of a major city or crashing the stock market, they will prove their worth. What the columnist said. Welcome to the new Cold War, said Michael Schrag in HarvardBusinessReview.org. Any company that has business dealings with China, competes with Chinese industries, or criticizes China's authoritarian government should now consider itself a frontline target. The sheer scale of the threat means that companies, whether digital startups or blue-chip behemoths, will have to partner with the government to develop a new military post-industrial complex to defend against these increasingly sophisticated attacks. Up to now, the Obama administration has been focused on playing offense in the cyber war, said Thomas Ridd in the New Republic. The Stuxnet virus that the U.S. and Israel launched against Iran's nuclear enrichment facilities was a prime example, but little has been done to address the country's major vulnerabilities, including the electricity grid. We're currently at a disadvantage, said John Argiella in foreignpolicy.com, because hackers are courted and pampered by the government of China, Russia, and other countries. In the U.S., they are treated like terrorists. Last month, Aaron Swartz, a talented 26-year-old hacker, killed himself rather than face a possible 35-year jail sentence for illegally accessing scholarly journals. The government should have hired Swartz instead of persecuting him. Want to fight back against China? Said Adam Siegel, also in foreignpolicy.com. Our hackers should mount a systematic effort to circumvent the Great Firewall of China and make Western reporting on the regime's corruption and brutality available to Chinese web users. The free flow of information is what China's government fears most, which is why it's our most potent weapon. That takes us to the section of the magazine entitled Controversy of the Week. This week's controversy? Hegel. Why was he so bad, and can he recover? Perhaps he failed to prepare himself properly, or perhaps he simply isn't bright, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. But in his Senate confirmation hearing last week, Defense Secretary nominee Chuck Hagel gave a completely disastrous performance. Under grilling from former colleagues on the Senate Armed Services Committee, the Nebraska Republican and decorated Vietnam vet came across as evasive, confused, and ill-informed, repeatedly retracting statements he'd made in the past and in the hearing itself. At one point, Hegel even wrongly said that Obama's policy on Iran's nuclear program was containment, that is, trying to limit the consequences of letting the mullahs build a bomb. When Senator Lindsey Graham challenged him to name one senator intimidated by the Jewish lobby, as Hegel once claimed many were, the flustered nominee stammered that he couldn't. Barring a GOP filibuster, Senate Democrats have enough votes to get Hegel confirmed, said William Crystal in WeeklyStandard.com. But after his dreadful performance, won't at least some Democrats announce, for the good of the country, that they will not consent to a Secretary of Defense unqualified for that high office? Hegel may have had a rough time, said John Avalon in the DailyBeast.com, but that's only because his Republican cross-examiners came at him with the pitchfork zeal of heretic hunters. To those paying attention, Hegel actually gave a series of reasonable, well-thought-out answers, but they were buried amid hours of sarcasm and open contempt from GOP neocons who had clearly not forgiven Hegel for warning that the Iraq war was a mistake. Hegel, as it happens, was right about Iraq, and so was then-Senator Obama, who called it a dumb war. A majority of the American public now sees it that way, too, and agrees with Obama's policy of avoiding unnecessary military involvement abroad, which is why the panicky neocons went after Hegel so aggressively. As for Senator Graham's question on Israel, said Stephen Walt in foreignpolicy.com, Hegel could have easily pointed to the hearing itself as a compelling vindication of the view that the Israeli lobby has an unhealthy influence on our politics. In a full day of questioning of America's next defense secretary, Israel was mentioned 166 times, and the threat to Israel from Iran 144 times. That's compared with only 20 mentions of Afghanistan, barely any mention of China, and none of drone warfare. There's a good reason why Hagel was so defensive and neutered in the hearing, said Peter Beinart in thedailybeast.com. Hagel's nomination could only fail, the Obama administration reasoned, if he were baited into a heated confrontation and said something he couldn't retract. The real Hagel is a man of strong conscience and views and is quite compelling when he's mad. Appearances matter, though, said Brett Stevens in the Wall Street Journal, especially in international affairs. It can only have come as a comfort to America's enemies to watch such a weak, bumbling performance by the man who'll soon be leading our armed forces. Even Democrats now know Hagel is damaged goods, said Jonathan Chait in NewYorkMag.com. Obama had hoped the Republican war hero would be a commanding figure who could sell a skeptical nation on his downsizing of this Pentagon and more cautious use of military. But Hagel's startlingly inept testimony last week created a buffoonish image he will probably never shake. For that reason, ironically, Republicans are probably better off with a wounded Hagel in office than voting him down. And on that same page, Controversy of the Week, we see this. Good week for, bad week for. It was a good week for people who are sick of Disney World after Pakistan revealed it was planning to build a $30 million amusement park and zoo in Abbottabad, the town where Osama bin Laden hid out. And it was a good week for ambitious stoners. After state authorities in Washington announced they were seeking a $100,000 a year marijuana consultant who knows how the recently legalized drug is best grown, dried, tested, labeled, packaged, and cooked into brownies. And finally, it was a good week for personal liberty. After an Icelandic 15-year-old who has been called, for all official purposes, girl, won a court battle to keep her given name, Blair. Iceland's government had refused to recognize the name Blair, which means light breeze, because it wasn't on the country's list of 1,853 approved girls' names. And it was a bad week for angering the poltergeist. After a power outage darkened part of New Orleans Superdome during the Super Bowl, causing a 34-minute delay of the game, some locals said the stadium is cursed because it was built on the site of a 19th-century cemetery. And it was a bad week for the Greensboro, North Carolina, News and Record, which announced its takeover by billionaire investor Warren Buffett in a front-page story headlined, Buffett Media Buys Paper. In his apology, the mortified editor wrote, a buffet involves food. The new owner is Buffett, spelled with two T's at the end rather than just one. The original headline then was Buffet Media Buys the Paper, misspelled. And it was a bad week for Donald Trump, who sued Bill Maher for $5 million. The comedian had vowed to give that sum to charity if Trump, in an adamant birther, could prove he was not the spawn of an orangutan. That was not a joke, Tumpfoon. That was venom. And that brings us to the section of the magazine entitled People. We have at least two articles here, What Fox Learned in the Lone Star State, and O'Connor's Stolen Youth. Jamie Fox is proud to be a Texan, said Zan Brooks in The Guardian, UK. The actor and singer has no illusions about his home state, where, he says, he experienced plenty of racism. In the mid-1980s, the then-teenage Fox went to play piano for a rich white family in his hometown of Terrell. He'd been driven to the house by a black school friend who was ordered to wait outside in the car until the performance was over. Quote unquote, "I can't have two niggers in my house at the same time," the homeowner explained. Instead of embittering him, such experiences left Fox with a cool-headed determination to make his way in the white world. "My grandmother worked as a homemaid all her life, and she taught me some truths. I learned those lessons in the South, and I did a pretty good job of it." He learned, among other things, not to view all white people the same way. Fox recently met former President George W. Bush in Dallas and found he liked him despite their political differences. Meeting those guys as just regular people outside of politics, you realize they're great people. They're just like me and you. There's a difference between the man and his politics. That's just the team they play for, but that Texas camaraderie, there's nothing like it. And then there's this, O'Connor's stolen youth. Well, Sinead O'Connor was raised by a kleptomaniac, said Nick Durden in The Independent, UK. Her mother used to go to houses that were for sale just so she could rob S out of them, says the Irish singer. It was funny, in a way, without being funny at all. You know, she'd go to hospitals and nick the crucifixes off the wall. She couldn't help herself, God rest her soul. It was an illness. O'Connor's mother violently abused her, and the only way she could stop the beatings was to go out thieving. I'd steal the pacifier. Despite being fast on her feet, I was a great sprinter, 100 meters in 11.3 seconds, O'Connor was caught shoplifting at age 15 and sent to a correctional facility run by the Catholic Church. She was forced to work in the building's basement, washing priests' clothes in sinks of cold water. One sympathetic nun took pity on her. Oh, she was very cool. She knew I loved music and encouraged me in it. The nun brought O'Connor her first guitar, and she was soon busking on Dublin streets and playing in local bands. "I suppose music saved me," she says. "I didn't have any other abilities, and there was no support for girls like me. It was either jail or music. I got lucky." That brings us to the section of the magazine entitled Briefing the Assault Weapon. Especially since the Newtown Massacre, military-style rifles have become the focus of America's gun debate. Well, what is an assault weapon? The term is notoriously difficult to define. Colloquially, it is used to describe commercially sold semi-automatic rifles with military-style features, including pistol grips, flash suppressors, and large detachable magazines. Like any semi-automatic gun, these rifles don't need to be reloaded after each shot. Depending on the size of the clip or magazine attached, they can fire anywhere from 10 to 100 rounds with each pull of the trigger firing a single round. Unlike military assault weapons, they are not automatic. That is, they do not fire continuously as long as the trigger is depressed. Automatic weapons, machine guns, are essentially illegal for civilian use. Second Amendment advocates argue that assault weapon is largely meaningless since it refers principally to cosmetic features such as flash suppressors and pistol grips. Any semi-automatic hunting rifle or semi-automatic pistol, they say, is just as lethal in the hands of a criminal or madman. How did assault weapons originate? The first was the Sturmgewehr 44, or storm rifle, developed in Nazi Germany during World War II and named by Adolf Hitler himself. The Russians used that design as the basis for their AK-47, still a popular template for many so-called selective-fire military assault rifles that work in both semi-automatic and automatic modes. In the U.S., the small arms engineering company Armal Light developed its own selective fire weapon, the AR-15, in 1957. The firearms manufacturer Colt acquired that design and used it to produce the M-16 for American forces in Vietnam, reserving the designation AR-15 for a semi-automatic version marketed to civilians. Many other manufacturers now make versions of the AR-15. Adam Lanza used a Bushmaster model in the December massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. In killing 20 first graders and 6 adults, Lanza fired hundreds of rounds, shooting each child 3 to 11 times each. How many are out there? Government data show that there are approximately 310 million firearms in the U.S., including 114 million handguns, 86 million shotguns, and 110 million rifles. How many of the latter are assault rifles is uncertain, but some analysts have estimated that the number is about 4 million. There's no doubt that sales of assault rifles are booming. Smith & Wesson sales of its M&P-15 assault rifle exploded from 4,600 in 2006 to 100,000 in 2010. That category of firearms has been a primary growth engine and profit driver for firearms companies for the last 7 or 8 years, said industry analyst Romel Dionisio. Why are these guns so popular? Designed to look menacing, they're lightweight, can fire 50 or more rounds per minute, and are relatively easy to use with a light kick. Guns are fun, said Philip Van Cleve, a Virginia gun activist, and some of them are much more cool than others. For many gun rights defenders, however, the real appeal of assault weapons is that they are the closest a civilian can get to wielding military firepower. The principle underlying the Second Amendment is resistance to federal tyranny, said David B. Koppel of the Cato Institute. The weapons that would be more suited to overthrow a dictatorial federal government would, of course, be weapons of war and not sports equipment. How often are assault weapons used in crime? Rarely. FBI data show that in 2011, 6,220 murders were committed with handguns, compared with 323 committed with rifles, only some of which were assault rifles. Killers who set out to massacre large numbers of people, however, often choose assault weapons, including James Holmes in Aurora, Colorado, 12 killed, 58 wounded, and Lanza in Newtown, 26 killed. Killers used assault weapons in 25 of the 62 mass shootings in the U.S. since 1982, a Mother Jones analysis found. That is, in 40% of such crimes. Another study found that mass killers who use assault weapons and/or high-capacity magazines have more than twice the number of victims, with an average of 15.6 people shot. So how effective would a ban be? It would have little impact on the 30,000 annual murders, homicides, accidents, and suicides involving firearms, since most are committed with handguns. The evidence, however, suggests an assault weapons ban might have some impact on mass shootings. During the decade the 1994 assault weapons ban was in place, mass shootings declined, with one notable exception, the 1999 massacre at Columbine High School in Colorado, in which one of the perpetrators' 4 guns was an assault weapon. Since the ban expired, the annual average toll from mass shootings has more than doubled, with 21 victims per year to 55. Christopher Koper, a criminologist who conducted a Justice Department review of the 1994 ban, thinks a renewed ban would modestly reduce gun deaths by reducing gun attacks, with particularly high numbers of shots fired. He estimates that a ban would prevent more than 100 shooting deaths a year. Given the horror and fear that incidents like Aurora and Newtown's evoke, Koper said, I wouldn't consider this trivial. And on that same page, this boxed inset, entitled Australia Semi-Automatic Rifle Ban. In 1996, a disturbed Australian gunman named Martin Bryant used two semi-automatic rifles to kill 35 people and wound 23. Shocked by the scale of the killings, Australia reacted by banning all semi-automatic and automatic rifles and shotguns. The ban was retroactive, so the government also funded a mandatory buyback program for all such weapons. Nearly 700,000 weapons were bought back, and what were the results? In the 18 years before the 1996 ban, Australia suffered 13 gun massacres, each with more than four victims, causing a total of 102 deaths. There has not been a single massacre since then. Few Australians would deny that their country is safer today, says former Prime Minister John Howard. But Howard notes that Australia and the U.S. are very different nations. Our gun lobby isn't as powerful or well-financed as the National Rifle Association, he says. Also, we have no constitutional right to bear arms. For those reasons, an Australian ban and buyback plan would have virtually no chance of passing through Congress. And that takes us to the section of the magazine entitled Best Columns, the U.S. We have three articles from that section. First is Carlos Lozada, The Washington Post, with one entitled The Plague of National Conversations. Then there's one by Peter Bergen of CNN.com, entitled Exaggerating the Danger of Al-Qaeda. And finally, there's one by Michael Serrazio, TheAtlantic.com, How Sports is Like a Religion. But first, the plague of national conversations. Enough with the national conversations, says Carlos Lozada. Obama, our national conversationalist-in-chief, has called on Americans to collectively discuss every problem we have, including gun violence, immigration, income inequality, obesity, bullying, and, of course, race. That's because the president, ever the community organizer, still believes thoughtful debate is the surest pathway to democratic progress, a nation arguing with its conscience, as he calls it in his memoir, The Audacity of Hope, and he's not alone. Conservative scold Bill Bennett is constantly calling for national conversations on religion and culture, and other politicians succumb to the same silly conceit. The reality is that our nation is deeply divided and our fiercely held and mutually exclusive opinions won't magically disappear if we frame them as feel-good conversation. Remember Obama's 2009 town hall debates on health care? They devolved into screaming arguments and the resulting law passed without a single GOP vote. And despite Obama's repeated calls for national discourse, Washington remains paralyzed. Talk is cheap and plentiful. Who wants more of it? And then there's exaggerating the dangers of Al-Qaeda. How much of a threat is posed by the latest incarnation of Al-Qaeda? Asked Peter Bergen. Chicken Littles are warning of the grave danger posed by the various ragtag groups of Islamic radicals now roaming Mali, Syria, Libya, and other North African nations. British Prime Minister David Cameron went so far to call these groups a large and existential threat. This is alarmist nonsense. The core of Al-Qaeda organization that launched 9/11 is in disarray and on the edge of extinction with Osama bin Laden dead and most of its backers erased by drone strikes. The paranoid, demoralized remnant has not mounted a successful terrorist strike on the West since 2005. As for its affiliates, various Al-Qaeda-aligned militant groups have alienated Muslims and failed to gain traction in Iraq, Yemen, Indonesia, and the Philippines. The same process is playing out in Mali, where the radicals imposed a brutal form of Sharia law and locals cheered when a small French force of 2,000 troops drove the bad guys out. Islamic militancy is ultimately self-defeating, and the threat it poses today is mostly local. Chicken Little's notwithstanding, we can all sleep soundly at night. And finally, there's this on how sports is like religion. With organized religion in decline in the U.S., what is filling the void? Asked Michael Sarazia. The Baltimore Ravens, the Red Sox, the Miami Heat, and so on. Even in our increasingly secular country, people still crave the sense of tribal belonging and mass transcendence that they once found in churches and temples. And if you look hard at sports, you can't help but see the contours of religion. Today, the cathedrals are called Wrigley Field, Madison Square Garden, and the Superdome. There, fans with allegiances that often date to their forefathers fill the pews, don the revered team's sacred vestments, and melt into a collective identity. At the game, at bars, or in living rooms, we experience ecstatic exaltation when we quote-unquote, triumph and collectively mourn our losses. We even imbue relics like players' jerseys, autographs, and Curt Schilling's bloody sock with iconic significance. Through sports, we fill in the empty places in our lives. We identify with something larger than ourselves. The salvation our devotion provides may not be everlasting, but it sure looks like religion to me. And that takes us to Talking Points, and here we have at least two articles, one entitled, The Sequester, Will It Trigger a Recession? And the other one, Immigration, the GOP's Internal Split. But first, The Sequester. Will it trigger a recession? In a logical, more Spock-like world, said Glenn Thrush in Politico.com, the news that the economy shrank in the final quarter of 2012 would prove to Republicans that America can't afford the looming automatic spending cuts known as the sequester. The fourth quarter contraction of 0.1% was almost entirely caused by a plunge in government spending, particularly a 22% cut by the Defense Department, and offers a chilling preview of what we can expect if the sequester cuts $1.2 trillion from the federal budget starting March 1. Those severe cuts, congressional analysts say, would cost our still-struggling economy 1.4 million public and private sector jobs, said the New York Times in an editorial. That would be nuts. The sequester was designed to be so unpalatable that it would force Democrats and Republicans to work out terms of a sane long-term budget. But having lost the fiscal cliff and debt ceiling showdowns to President Obama, Republicans are now saying the sequester is preferable to no cuts at all. In other words, bring on the unemployment. Please, Republicans, don't back off, said Larry Kudlow in RealClearPolitics.com. The economy overall may have shrunk slightly at year's end, but the private sector grew a very respectable 3.4% in 2012. If the sequester goes ahead, the reduced size of government will let the private sector breathe, leading to accelerated growth and a return to true prosperity. Allowing the sequester may be an idea whose time has finally come, said John Sununu in the Boston Globe. The president needs to learn that you can't tax your way out of a spending crisis, and the sequester's cuts really aren't that awful. 7.3% for the Pentagon and 5.1% for domestic programs. Companies make cuts of that size every year just to stay competitive. It's high time federal agencies learned how to downsize. If the sequester kicks in, Democrats will have themselves to blame, said Edward Luce in Financial Times. They've so adamantly resisted any cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and social programs that long-term deficit reduction is impossible. Even the various proposed alternatives to the sequester, a round of more targeted cuts or Obama's proposal for closing tax loopholes, are going to suck $1.2 trillion out of the economy almost immediately. There is nothing about the anemic U.S. recovery that merits austerity at this point. Yet Washington, in its dysfunction, seems to determine to inflict it. Immigration. The GOP's internal split. Immigration reform is coming, said Charles Krauthammer in the Washington Post, and this time Republicans need to get it right. Still reeling from the November election in which President Obama won more than 70% of the Hispanic vote, some Senate Republicans, led by Florida's Marco Rubio, are proposing legislation that would let the 11 million illegal immigrants in the country gain legal status, but only after steps are taken to stop others from crossing the border. If a truly effective Israeli-style fence can be extended along the border, then the party has no humane or politically pragmatic choice but to support Rubio's proposal. Immigrants come to this country looking for freedom and prosperity through hard work, said Mark Kennedy in FoxNews.com. Those are core Republican values. If the GOP can shed its nativist stigma by embracing immigration reform, it has a chance to become a governing party again. Republicans are on the brink of an epic blunder, said Pat Buchanan in the AmericanConservative.com. The party's leaders have convinced themselves that religious, hardworking Hispanics are natural conservatives, but it isn't true. Hispanics just aren't small government people. With a majority of their children born out of wedlock and to single-parent homes and millions of them getting food stamps and Medicaid benefits, why would these folks vote for a Republican Party that promises to downsize the big government upon which they depend for sustenance, security, and survival? If illegals are allowed to become citizens, it will demoralize the Republican base while handing Democrats millions of loyal new voters. There goes the presidency forever. Republican stereotypes about immigrants are simply wrong, said David Brooks in the New York Times. Solid research shows that immigrants are 30% more likely to start new businesses than native-born Americans. They pay more in taxes than they receive in benefits, and by increasing the supply of low-skilled labor, they bring down the cost of food, construction, and child care for all of us. Giving illegal immigrants a path to citizenship would increase the taxes they pay by $48 billion a year. Given the overwhelming strength of the evidence, Republicans have to overcome their fears and support the Rubio-led proposal. If Congress fails to address immigration reform once again, then we really are a pathetic basket case of a nation. Takes us to the last word. And this week's last word is entitled The Inner Life of Plants. The history of the search for plant consciousness, says Latif Nassar, actually tells us more about ourselves. A carrot is strapped to an examining table. After the experimenter wires it up to a galvanometer, he pinches the vegetable with forceps. The machine registers. Infinitesimal twitches, starts, and tremors, according to one report. The year is 1914. The scientist is named Jagadish Chandra Bose, and a journalist in the room writes, apparently without irony, Thus can science reveal the feelings of even so stolid a vegetable as the carrot. Today, that conclusion and the experiment seems absurd. Whatever is happening inside a carrot is not a feeling, in any sense we'd understand. For that, a carrot would need a brain, or at least a central nervous system, which it most certainly does not have. The scientific consensus is clear. Plants do not experience the world the way we do. We can't equate human behavior to the ways in which plants function in their worlds, writes David Chamovitz, who runs a plant biology lab at Tel Aviv University and surveys the field in a new book, What a Plant Knows. He considers that title a kind of literary shorthand, even a provocation, rather than a serious suggestion that plants can think. In hindsight, it's easy to look back on Bose's experiments as novelty science, but Bose was widely respected, a serious scientist who would soon be knighted for his achievements. And the question of the humanness of plants has a history that stretches far before him and well after. Three generations of Darwins experimented on the surprising capabilities of plants. Unlikely figures from other realms dove in, too. Former CIA operatives, a Presbyterian minister, even Scientology founder L. Ron Hubbard. Plants might not have minds, but the researchers weren't entirely misdirected in wondering just how deep plants' abilities run. Over the last decade, researchers have discovered that even primitive green algae can sense dangers or changes in a light direction and intensity, and that a pea plant in drought conditions can communicate its stress to its soil mates, and warn them to prepare for hard times. It has again become tempting to dangle the possibility, does this mean plants could be conscious? The question may be revealing, but not for the reasons one might think. Today, a glance back at the long, strange inquiry into plant consciousness finds that it might not explain much about plants, but it can tell us a lot about what's going in the world outside the flower pot. For most of history, when humans speculated about the inner nature of plants, we did it in the language of souls or spirits. Aristotle postulated that a plant has a vegetal soul, but is incapable of sensation. Many traditional religions of the past and present, like Jainism, consider plants to possess souls, and followers treat them accordingly. With the Enlightenment and the emergence of a plant science in its own right, botanists in the West began trying to document those inner lives with data. Physician Thomas Percival catalogued observations that persuaded him that plants had basic senses like balance and body awareness. For instance, a sprig of mint suspended upside down grew upwards instead of sprouting towards the ground. He noted that two separate honeysuckle shoots seemed to draw together for mutual support. Percival had great hopes for what might be discovered going on inside. He confessed his hopes that someone might discover plants' capacity for enjoyment, because if so, the aggregate of happiness produced by plants will be found to exceed our most enlarged conceptions. Percival was no outlier. The impulse was so widespread among serious scientists that when Charles Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus, wrote his massive 1800 tome, Phytologia, or the Philosophy of Agriculture and Gardening, he was able to recount a number of contemporary experiments. One scientist stimulated barberry flowers with a pin. Another zapped a balsam with electricity. A third shipped apple trees to New York to see whether they'd accommodate to the new time zone. Erasmus Darwin's conclusion? Have vegetable buds irritability? Have they sensation? Have they volition? I am persuaded they possess them all. In an 1839 monograph on blushing, mostly in humans, British physician Thomas Henry Burgess included a chapter in which he claimed that plants could similarly wither or droop in response to external impressions. Pioneer American horticulturist Luther Burbank spoke to his saplings, mollycoddling them with what he called a vibration of love. The childless bachelor Burbank thought his green thumb qualified him enough to write a child-rearing manual titled, aptly enough, The Training of the Human Plant. Even Charles Darwin himself was drawn to the question, running experiments such as having his budding botanist son, Francis, play the bassoon. To a sensitive mimosa plant, just to see what would happen, nothing did. Darwin later called it a fool's experiment. His second-to-last book was titled The Power of Movement in Plants and included a rather provocative interpretation of root growth. It is hardly an exaggeration to say, he wrote, that the tip of a plant's radicle acts like the brain of one of the lower animals, receiving impressions from the sense organs and directing the several movements. The hint that a plant might have a brain became even more alluring in the early 20th century. Darwin's own son led the charge, claiming in Nature in 1901 that there is nothing unscientific in classing animals and plants together from a psychological standpoint. And in a 1908 issue of Science, we must believe that in plants there exists a faint copy of what we know as consciousness in ourselves. In 1905, botanist Raoul France's Germs of Minds in Plants reached a similar point. What grander lesson could the speechless plants give than that which they have taught us? That their sense life is a primitive form, the beginning of the human mind. Nobody seemed to pursue this question with more enthusiasm than Bose. In addition to his carrot wiring experiment, Bose engineered an altogether different series of devices to record plants' handwriting in the form of ticker tape-like dots on a smoked glass plate. As a science writer noted in 1915, Bose's ingenious recorders are pins of incredible lightness with which lilies or cabbages may write down their impressions of the outer world. Bose was particularly interested in the way plants reportedly jerked the very moment before they died. In his words, our mute companions, silently growing beside our door, have now told us the tale of their life, tremulousness, and their death spasm in script as inarticulate as they. Plant consciousness faded from legitimate science, but enjoyed a significant popular renaissance in post-war America. In 1959's The Power of Prayer on Plants, Presbyterian minister Franklin Lohr claimed that prayed over seedlings thrived while prayed against ones seemed to twist and writhe under the negative power. And in the 1960s and 1970s, a potent cocktail of silent spring-era environmentalism, New Age spirituality, and Watergate-inspired mistrust of authority gave new energy to claims about what might really be going on with plants. Darwin's bassoon recital found a second wind in the work of Dorothy Retallack, a Denver-area grandmother who published The Sounds of Music and Plants in 1973. The result of experiments that she conducted for a college biology class, her results as summed up by a New York Times headline, "Houseplants Hate Hard Rock." Science fiction writer and Church of Scientology founder L. Ron Hubbard developed a theory that plants share human emotions. In 1968, Life magazine ran a photo of Hubbard plugging crocodile clips into either side of a tomato, an experiment that Hubbard claimed as proof that tomatoes scream when they're sliced. Most provocative of all was a 1973 book titled The Secret Life of Plants, which featured the experiments of Cleve Baxter, a polygraph specialist convinced that plants could read minds. Baxter shared his findings with the Stanford Research Institute, where experimenters were concerned with paranormal topics such as remote viewing, the ability to see distant hidden locations. At the time, this research was top secret, funded as part of the CIA's project MKUltra to develop psychic weapons for use in the Cold War. Oddly enough, Baxter and both of the writers of The Secret Life of Plants all formerly worked for the CIA, and at the time many of the key Stanford researchers were Scientologists. Whatever these experiments revealed about plants, it's not hard to see what they revealed about people's shifting preoccupations. The 18th century empiricists focused on measurable sensations. The 19th century studies reflect a distinctly romantic concern for emotions and sentiment, an attitude that also cropped up in the floridly written home gardening manuals of the time. Around the turn of the 20th century, the new science of the human mind, psychology, triggered a corresponding hunt for the plant mind. The 60s and 70s counterculture reimagined plants as silent pacifist sufferers. At the same time, napalm reigned over the jungles of Vietnam. Today, research on plants doesn't start from the assumption that they may be able to think or feel or read minds. Nonetheless, scientists are building a picture of how plants sense the world that is remarkably complex. In 2006, Penn State researchers demonstrated that the parasitic dodder vine can smell the difference between wheat and tomato plants. In 2007, a pair of Canadian researchers determined that plants can tell the difference between their own kin and strangers of the same species. Plants have this kind of hidden but complicated social life, one of the researchers said. As scientists piece together that plant sensorium, some of those earlier notions are getting a boost from the modern obsession with neuroscience. The past few years have seen the emergence of plant neurobiology, a new field that flirts with the idea of a vegetal mind. Proponents of the field look for chemical, electrical, and anatomical similarities between animals and plants, for instance, between information networks in plants and nervous systems in animals, or between the architecture of roots and the architecture of neurons. Plant neurobiologists have their own conferences, their own journal, even their own professional society. The approach isn't without controversy. 36 botanists signed a letter to a prominent research journal in 2007 saying the field is, quote-unquote, founded on superficial analogies and questionable extrapolations. Chamovitz, who heads Tel Aviv's Mana Center for Plant Biosciences, dismisses the concept of plant intelligence as a scientifically useful idea. To him, it does not further our understanding of either intelligence or plant biology, but as his book title attests, he recognizes the power of metaphor to help us make connections that we might not normally make. In a phone interview, he pressed the point even further. I don't really think hardcore scientists think that plants are sentient in any way that mammals are sentient, he said. But plant neurobiologists are challenging us to redefine for ourselves what we mean by sentient. So what is going on inside that begonia on your windowsill? The question is tantalizingly unanswerable, and despite all the odds stacked against us, we'll probably never stop asking it. Chamovitz himself admits to talking to the plants in his lab. His explanation? Why? Why do people pray? Why do people talk to God? The plants have yet to weigh in. And that brings us to the section called Poll Watch. Turns out that 43% of Americans say the government is definitely or probably concealing the existence of extraterrestrial life on Earth. That's from the Angus Reid Public Opinion. And from Public Religion Research Institute, we see the following poll watch. 27% of Americans believe God plays a direct role in determining which teams win sports events. 53% believe God rewards athletes who have faith with success. And finally, this section here on the U.S. at a glance, we have this article from Washington, D.C., the USPS to cut service. United States Postal Service announced this week it would stop delivering mail on Saturdays in a bid to save the cash-strapped agency $2 billion a year. The Postal Service will begin five-day-a-week mail delivery on August 1, though it will still deliver packages and urgent deliveries such as medicine on Saturdays. Post offices will also remain open on that day. The cutback was expected as the Postal Service grapples with huge losses totaling $15.9 billion last year alone. Congress is likely to oppose the change, but postal officials believe they can use a gap between appropriation bills in March to push it through without congressional approval. Around 7 in 10 Americans support ending Saturday delivery, but Postal Union official Frederick Rolando said it would harm small businesses, rural communities, the elderly, and the disabled. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The Week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, filling in for George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Services wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long. Until next time.